Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Hello, welcome to the Commonwealth. Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting. We are also welcome our radio and internet audience, and we welcome everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. My name is Dr. Patrick O'Reilly. I'm the chair of the Psychology Forum, and I am genuinely delighted to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Tan Nguyen. Dr. Nguyen is a clinical psychologist. She is the behavioral health director of Tri-City Health Center, overseeing the mental health and social service programs, including the medication-assisted treatment program for substance abuse. She received her postdoctoral training at the National Center for PTSD at the VA practice, the VA Palo Alto Health Center. Her training and research focused on bringing best practices to frontline clinicians and finding solutions to systematic issues related to larger adoption of best practice. So please welcome Dr. Nguyen.
Thank you, Patrick, for the invitation as well as the kind introduction. And good evening, everyone, and welcome to our talk today on the intersection of pain and addiction. As Patrick mentioned, I oversee our medication-assisted treatment program at Tri-City, which is a federally qualified health center located in Fremont, so in South County in Alameda. And so I'll talk a bit about my experience in terms of how I got to this work and what I've learned in terms of where I am in this process of developing this program. And some of the things we're doing locally are sort of at our clinic, as well as what we're doing statewide to address the opioid epidemic. So just to give a little background, in 2015, my boss, who's the CEO of the organization, approached me and said, we have this new funding opportunity that's come our way. It's from the federal government, and it's about expanding our primary care services to provide substance use treatment. And he says, we don't really do substance use in primary care. I said, I know. And I said, so this is sort of a big deal. Is this something we're ready to do? And he said, I'm not sure. And I said, I've been reading about sort of what's been going on with the opioid crisis, just sort of as someone who's interested, and I'm an interested community member, and kind of following in the news and sort of hearing about what's been happening more nationally as well as locally. And I think that we should, at the very least, try to be a part of the solution. So he said, okay, if you're willing to sort of work on the proposal, come up with a plan, I'm willing to support you to do that. So I did. And 8.5 months pregnant, I submitted the proposal a day before I gave birth to our second baby, who's now 2.5 and turning 3 in September. So I left maternity leave. I submitted it. I said, here it is. I can't make any more edits. I'm going to the hospital. And and I sort of was off the grid for 6 weeks. And I came back, sort of, you know, work as usual. And then I get a call, and he said, and he goes, hi, I just wanted to give you an update. I got some news about our proposal. So you can probably guess what the results were, because I wouldn't be here in front of you, all of you today, to talk about this if we didn't get it. So we got the funding. We were one of 3 organizations in Alameda County to get it. And he said, so now it's up to you. How do you want to sort of roll this out? And I thought, okay, you know, I sort of done all this research. There are lots of best practices on what to do, and I've got a plan. So I'll tell you a little bit about sort of what happened with that plan, where we landed, where our program is today. And before I do that, though, I'll talk a bit about sort of pain and the intersection of addiction, and then we'll get to some of the treatment programs. So just to start with a definition, a standard definition of pain, pain is described as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience that is often associated with actual or perceived tissue damage. And chronic pain is sort of having these uncensored or unpleasant experiences for a long time, and sometimes it's not as bad, and other times it gets worse. And like other chronic conditions, it requires ongoing management. So chronic pain is prevalent. More than 100 million Americans experience chronic pain every day. 1 out of 10 experience pain every day for 3 months. And the data shows that about 3 out of 4 people experience pain or know someone, a family or friend who also experiences pain. It affects more people than cancer, diabetes, and heart disease combined. And it's expensive. So it cost in 2010 over $560 billion in terms of costs related to healthcare, lost wages, disability benefits. And so as a result, healthcare providers were tasked with a common and really lofty goal, and that was to minimize people's pain. And so you might think that as a result of that, we're going to do some really great work. But the opioid epidemic actually arose out of a desire to do good. So opioid use and abuse is a major public health crisis out of a desire that was driven sort of really out of a desire as a healthcare and a sort of community together to do something good for each other. And so let's talk a little bit about how we got there. So in the early 1990s, several medical pain societies really pushed for improved pain management. They saw it as sort of a public health imperative, and they really believed that we weren't doing enough at the time to treat pain, and that as a result of that, it was really leading to high levels of physical and emotional disabilities. Around the same time in 1996, Purdue Pharma put out OxyContin in the market, and they aggressively marketed OxyContin as an effective and safe treatment for pain. And similarly, sort of around the same time as well, in 1996, the American Pain Society argued that pain should be assessed and treated like a fifth vital sign. And then in 2001, there were regulatory policies that were put out that really sort of encouraged regular assessment of pain at every face-to-face encounter, whether it was a primary care visit, a hospital visit, that it was really aggressively sort of marketed this idea that we have to effectively treat people's pain. And that the way that we assess was really based on what the person was telling us, that pain, in terms of how it's experienced between individuals, is really unique. And so we as providers needed to trust what our patients and the folks that we were working with were telling us in terms of their experience of pain, and we needed to adequately respond to that. In 2001, there were hospital regulations that came out that really sort of tied patient satisfaction to payments from third-party payers. And what you saw in some of the data is that patients who had high opioid prescriptions also had higher patient satisfaction scores. And so this was saw in sort of a study of 60,000 patients in a hospital over in the East Coast. And so what was the result of all this social advocacy, this sort of aggressive pharmaceutical advertising, is that we saw an upsurge in opioid prescribing. So from 1999 to 2012, opioid prescriptions quadrupled. And in 2016, as you can see, there were 214 million opioid prescriptions written in the U.S., and the U.S. is 5% of the world's population, and we consumed 99% of the world's hydrocodone. 80% of the world's oxycodone. And so one would guess that pain was effectively managed, right? And what we found was, in a CDC study, was pain levels were kind of the same. And we saw sort of a fourfold increase in opioid overdose and a fourfold increase in admissions to treatment facilities for opioid use and abuse. And so in 2016, there were an estimated 2 million people in the U.S. who suffered from substance use-related disorders as a result of prescription opioids. So, and another way to sort of look at this data is in 2016, there were more deaths related to opioid overdose than firearms or motor vehicle accidents. And one of the things here is sort of a trend. You can see from 2000 to about 2010, there was this huge uptake in the light blue line, which is the prescription opioids and prescribing of prescription opioids. And where the dip is sort of between 2010 and 2012 is there were some state as well as federal policies around curbing the prescription prescriptions of opioids. And so you see sort of this dip. And then in correspondence is what you see is an increase in heroin around that same time. And so some of you probably are familiar with reading that opioid prescription is a risk factor, actually, for going on to use heroin as well as fentanyl. So in the light, sort of the darker blue line is the fentanyl line. That's a synthetic opioid. And what we're starting to see now, starting around 2012 and really seeing an increase, more so in the East Coast than over in the West Coast, but a huge increase in opioid overdose deaths related to fentanyl. So in California, we had 1,882 overdose deaths related to prescription opioids in 2017, and we had over 21 million prescription opioids written. In Alameda County, there were 35 deaths in 2017 and over 700,000 prescriptions for opioids written. And there is about 6,000, an estimate of 6,000 to 9,000 individuals who suffer from opioid use disorder. We have about a little over 8,500 medical providers, and about 3% of them can actually provide the treatment for opioid use disorder in terms of medication-assisted treatment. So there still continues to be a need and an access issue. So this is just a summary in terms of what we've been talking about up to this point. So again, in the 1990s, there is huge advocacy for improving pain management, seeing pain as a fifth vital sign, pain management standards, misleading information from pharmaceutical companies, and then inappropriate ties between pharmaceutical companies and healthcare organizations. A huge increase in opioid prescriptions from 1999 to 2012. Nearly 2 million Americans who struggle with addiction currently, and over 42,000 deaths in 2016 nationally. So where are we now in terms of the opioid epidemic? Really, we sort of think about it in three phases, with the first phase being the prescription opioids from 1996 to 2012, the prescription opioids being a risk factor, many because of some of the state regulations in 2012, we saw a huge increase in heroin use, and then now seeing the fentanyl and other synthetic opioids as people develop tolerance and need higher potency to have the same sort of effects. And this is just a brief video about Tri-City, which I won't play because we don't have audio currently, but I'll tell you a bit about Tri-City. And so we're going to talk now about what we've done at Tri-City to address this need and to sort of fix it. And really the approach is about changing the way we manage chronic pain, and that can start with the primary care clinics, and that we want to be able to increase access to, you know, more effective chronic pain management as well as substance use treatment within the primary care clinics. So Tri-City Health Center, as I mentioned earlier, is located in Fremont, and we're a federally qualified health center, an FQHC, the only one in Fremont, and there are 8 in Alameda County, and we provide health care to anyone in the community who needs it, regardless of their ability to pay, regardless of status. It started out in 1970 as a family planning clinic in downtown Fremont in a little Victorian home, so that's what I read in our website, and since then has really grown and became a federally qualified health center about 20 years ago. We provide medical, behavioral health, dental, as well as vision services, and have staff, a very diverse staff with over 21 languages represented in our staff. So this just gives you a bit about what we did in 2016. We had over 152,000 medical visits, including or healthcare visits. We serve a fairly diverse ethnic population, and primarily adults. We do have a pediatric clinic as well as a teen clinic, and we served over 25,000 patients in 2016. a little more females than male. And we also have a well sort of recognized, nationally recognized transgender program. So at Tri-City, we really took a multimodal approach to addressing the opioid crisis. And so I'll be speaking about each a little bit today. The first is at a patient level, really increasing access to substance use in a primary care context. Also at a provider level, and discussing some of the initiatives and strategies that we've implemented to provide education and training to change prescription practices, as well as adopting more effective evidence-based interventions. And then at a systems level, and speaking about the local coalition that I participate in and some of the things we're doing statewide across the state with the 24 different coalitions. So the MAT, or medication-assisted treatment model, that we apply at Tri-City is a comprehensive treatment program for opioid use disorder that includes behavioral therapy, counseling, support services, and FDA-approved medication. And in general, in terms of medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder, there are three main medications: methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone. At our clinic, we primarily use buprenorphine, and so I'll spend most of my time speaking about that, but to know that there are three main medications. So we have, again, a sort of more comprehensive biopsychosocial approach, really trying to address all of the different aspects of an individual, of a person, and being able to have parts of our program that are able to address any of those components or perspectives. We're able to provide the medication, counseling, as well as complementary alternative treatments like acupuncture, like chiropractor, some of them. They sort of have varying degrees of evidence in terms of effectiveness, but because of the diverse patient population that we serve, we really wanted to have treatments that were culturally responsive to the patient population. It's a team-based approach, so we've got lots of different disciplines working together, and it's a harm reduction approach. We're really trying to meet the person that comes through our door, regardless of which door they come through, where they're at. So right now, they're just wanting someone to give them information, we can do that. If they're wanting someone to help link their family to certain information, we can do that. If they're ready for treatment, they want counseling, they want to do a group, we can help them do that. And it's really about sort of being partners with our team members, as well as the individual who's asking us for help. And so we want to hear them and be responsive to what their needs are. When we sort of start with treatment, we go through the informed consent process. We talk about the pros and cons, risks and benefits of treatment. And we also talk about treatment expectations, so including adhering and following up with medical appointments, urine drug screens, random pill counts. And these are sort of new processes in a primary care context. So in a substance use clinic, this is sort of a natural workflow. And for us, this is sort of really different, this idea of sort of monitoring how and sort of holding people accountable with some of this data. And so letting the individual know these are part of the treatment expectations. Knowing that, asking if we can speak to their family and friends, other service providers that they work with, so we can coordinate care. These are things we sort of let them know about upfront. And we try to set the expectations, like, we're here to let us know where you're at, and there's nothing you can't tell us, we want to work with you. And there's not this sense of being, you know, sort of fired from the program. We do place contingencies because we do hold people accountable, and that's important. But there's we try to stay away from this idea that you'll ever really be kicked out of the program. Maybe you take a little pause, and you're always welcome back. So again, we have a multidisciplinary team. So the waiver providers essentially mean to be able to prescribe buprenorphine, for opioid use disorder, medical providers have to undergo a certain type of training. And so we've got a number of those providers who have completed that training, and they're qualified to provide this treatment in our clinic. And some of you may have heard know that buprenorphine is also approved for pain management in general. So if they're using it for pain management, they do not need to go through this specialized training. But if it's for opioid use disorder or an addiction problem, then they are required to go through this specialized training. We also have a team of medical assistants, counselors. KDAC stands for Certified Alcohol Drug Counselor. And then, of course, the sort of base or of this team are the individuals and their social support, including their family and friends. And without all of these people, it's really hard to sort of have a balanced treatment approach and to be able to provide the comprehensive components of the program. So who is a good fit for this treatment? Naturally someone who has an opioid use disorder, who has an addiction problem with an opioid, someone who voluntarily engages in treatment, someone who is able to sort of at some level manage their own treatment, because this is outpatient-based treatment, doesn't have any other sort of medical contraindications, understands treatment expectations, understands the treatment alternatives, and is choosing this treatment option. So this is Dr. Vivek Murthy, and I had he was the 19th U.S. Surgeon General, and I met him last year at an event in San Jose. And he put out a Surgeon's General report, I believe in January 2016, called Facing Addiction in America. And in it, he talks about sort of the stigma around addiction, substance use, and how that impacts people's choices in terms of accessing care. And that we sort of have this idea around substance use or individuals who have an addiction problem as having a moral failing, and that we need to sort of shift away from that and really see it as a chronic medical condition and treat it like a chronic medical condition like we do diabetes or hypertension. That in order to do this, it really had to come from the community and the community health centers, and that we were sort of a big base to push this movement forward. I'll share a sort of a patient story around how impactful stigma can be. This patient is someone that I was working with at our clinic in his mid-40s, had three overdoses by the time that I had seen him, and he was referred to our program, and he had declined our services. Actually, he didn't want buprenorphine, and he said I had sort of asked him why, and he said, "Well, I'm not an addict. I was using it for my pain, and I just had a really bad reaction." And as I've gotten to know him, he continues to attend our relapse prevention group. But to speak to, and even in the groups when we're having conversations with other peers, he says, "Well, I'm not an addict. I have a real chronic pain issue, and I just had a really bad reaction those few times. But I'm here because I want to support everyone." It was just too much of a disconnect for him to be able to sort of accept or acknowledge that this could be a real problem for him. And it's something we continue to sort of work with in terms of just meeting him where he's at and really hearing his perspective. I sort of share that story to illustrate how strong stigma can be from a patient level or an individual level, and that I also think it's true from a provider level. And I share that to say that at a primary care clinic, sort of the way healthcare centers or health services were provided is if there's a specialty, you refer the person out, to these specialists, whatever the sort of specialty care is needed. And substance use, as well as behavioral health or mental health services, is a specialty. So to bring it to primary care is the merging of really different kinds of world and a model that is sort of makes sense and in practice really challenging to do. So I do think that not only is stigma true and real and still there for the patient level, but it's also real and true and still there for the provider level as well. And that sort of we have to sort of acknowledge and address both of those in order to really move this forward. As I mentioned, there are three FDA-approved medications. Methadone, which is the dark blue line, it's a full agonist. It's a full, what I call mu agonist, where there's a certain receptor in our brains called the mu receptors, and methadone is if you think of puzzle pieces, a perfect fit for that receptor. Typically has about a 36 half-life in terms of how long sort of it's in your system. So generally you might hear about people who go to the methadone clinic and they get their daily dose. This is a treatment that is only available in opioid treatment programs. And then the light green line is buprenorphine. It's a partial agonist, so it makes it really safe. And most formulations of it also contain naloxone, which is the antidote. And so there's really low chances of overdose, as well as reduced chances of diversion of buprenorphine. And it generally lasts anywhere between 24 to 36 hours. And then naltrexone is an antagonist. So in other words, it sort of blocks the mu receptor, doesn't really allow anything to go and bind with that receptor. Generally, individuals who receive this treatment would need to have medical withdrawal, sort of monitored medical withdrawal, and then receive naltrexone 7 to 10 days after. And so for that reason, it's very hard, actually, to get individuals into this treatment, because there has to be a short period of abstinence from use. And so what we found is, I'll talk more specifically about buprenorphine. What we found is buprenorphine is really effective and it's safe. So it reduces mortality in the first phases of treatment, as well as ongoing maintenance and stability. So buprenorphine, in terms of providing in an outpatient setting, has sort of three primary stages to its treatment. It's what we call the induction phase. And generally, we do that at home now, where people can get started, individuals can get started onto this treatment. There's a certain stage of withdrawal in which they would start on this medication. If they start too soon or too late, it may actually precipitate withdrawal. And then we also have, it takes about anywhere between 2 to 4 weeks to find a stable dose. In general, 24 milligrams is sort of the general dose that most individuals land at as the dose that helps them maintain their withdrawal, as well as their withdrawal symptoms, as well as their cravings. And when this treatment is initiated, generally we'll have conversations with the individual around what are the most common withdrawal symptoms that you typically experience, and we'll also provide medication to help with that, whether it's sort of feeling kind of agitated or irritable, body aches, throwing up, constipation, those different, and so we'll also offer medications to manage those withdrawal symptoms as well, and then maintenance and then stabilization stage, and typically that's when they've identified a dose that's effective and able to manage their withdrawal symptoms and allow them to sort of focus on other things other than and finding that the next time they'll be able to get the drug. And it's also been found to be helpful with reducing pain. So it helps with reducing mortality and pain management. So that's the medication piece of our program. We also have the sort of behavioral health component, where we offer a relapse prevention group as well as ongoing individual counseling. And this is primarily based on cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a type of evidence-based intervention for a wide range of mental health diagnoses. And the sort of premise of this intervention is that there's a bi-directional relationship between the way that what we think, what we're doing, and how we feel. So this idea that then we could intervene at the thought level or at the behavioral level to impact the way the person's feeling. And if you recall from the definition of pain, it's both a sensory as well as a sort of emotional experience. But here's that sort of treatment for that part of the definition. That one, we want to, that based on sort of some of the thoughts around how they're managing their pain, it can really impact the experience of it, heightened this experience of pain, and also impact what they're doing. So generally what happens is when an individual is experiencing pain, naturally I do the same thing as I think, oh, I should take a break. I shouldn't really be doing anything until the pain sort of gets better or subsides. And that's true generally if you have acute pain. But for chronic pain, if you are waiting for it to subside, that might not happen for a long time or might not happen at all. So the less you do, the less you want to do. And so it becomes sort of this cyclical cycle of feeling like you're waiting. You then start to have negative thoughts about yourself and sort of what you're doing. You're doing less, and now your experience of pain is intensified. And so we try, there's education as part of our work around therapy, whether it's in an individual or group context, talking about thought interventions that we can do at the thought level, at the well as the behavioral level, and then connecting them really to their community in terms of their family, their friends, and how to sort of be involved. And so that happens both at an individual level as well as a group level. We, in the group, we also, what I like about the group is that there's opportunity opportunity for peer-to-peer feedback, and that's really much more powerful than hearing from me or another healthcare provider, because I'm not as relatable. I can sort of say, here's what we know in science, here's some of the research, you know, I can direct you to that, I can show you a video, but it's much more powerful when it's coming from someone who has lived experiences and shared experiences and can say, hey, this is what worked for me, and you could try it, it might work for you, it might not, but you know, it's better than where you're at. And so I like the group format in that way, in that there's this direct peer-to-peer feedback.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
We also have a yoga of 12-step recovery. And this is a sort of group that's based on the principles of yoga as well as 12-step recovery, and combining sort of looking at our the way that our body carries our pain, and how to use some of the principles of yoga to help manage that, and this idea around sort of mindfulness, showing up to where we're at, being in the moment, and allowing sort of our decisions or our choices to be guided by what's important to us rather than the fleeting thoughts that are coming through our mind that comes and goes all the time. And also the principles of 12-step recovery is combined with that, and typically done in a group format. And there are some situations where also we'll do it in an individual format, depending on what the individual needs of the person is. And then this is just a quote from one of the patients in our program. He's a late 20s client who was actually an external referral and was using heroin since he was at the age of 15. So he said, I just wanted to say thank you to all the staff for accepting and helping me out. I've gone to other programs, but none like this. It's just a good feeling to know that there is help out there. I don't know what else to say, but thank you, and I appreciate the continuous help. And he's one of our sort of model patients, if you could say that. He comes every week to our groups. He's very supportive of the peers in the group and really responsive, adheres to all of his medical appointments. And it's been a real pleasure for me to see him change from when he started with our program and where he's at now. He's back in school. He has a part-time job, saving up and wanting to move out and live independently. So we'll wish him the best of luck. So that was sort of at the patient level in terms of our MAP program, and that was really sort of a large overview. And then I'm going to talk about what we're doing at our provider level in terms of education and training. We participate in an initiative, a partnership with Alameda County Healthcare Services and a new startup company, because, you know, we're in San Francisco, and so we've got to have some tech in whatever it is that we're doing, called Elemento Health. And it was an initiative to bring a cloud-based virtual coach to our healthcare providers in any sort of handheld device, where they could have immediate access to best practices. So the CDC put out chronic pain best practice guidelines, workflows, and sort of how-to videos. And so they can immediately access this. And we also had a medication reconciliation module as part of this that we had our MA medical assistants participate in. And we did interprofessional gamification to engage them into actually using this tool. So one of the things that we find is we have so many cool tools here, but they actually aren't utilized as much as we'd like them to be. And so we were trying to find a way to get our team to actually utilize this tool that could really help them respond when they're with someone in the exam room and able to sort of alter the way that they're working with chronic pain. And so we had this interprofessional gamification to engage them, where they would get sort of scores or points based on how many people signed up for the app, how many actually utilized it, and then actually used one of the tools that was in there. And then the leading clinic, and it was based on clinics, the leading clinic got cupcakes So it wasn't a huge incentive, but it was sort of nice for the clinic. And we actually had a tie between two of our clinics, so they both got cupcakes. And we did absolutely see a change. So we had a number of initiatives. One was increasing the prescribing of co-prescribing of naloxone, which is an overdose antidote. So before the initiative, we had less than 10. Prior to the initiative, we had more than 51 co-prescribing of naloxone with chronic pain patients who were on long-term opioid therapy. We also wanted to see more referrals to MAT. We saw an increase, about a 30% increase referral to our MAT program. And we encouraged providers to try other treatment options as first-line treatment for chronic pain other than opioid therapy. So we saw an increase to referrals to chiropractic services, to our behavioral health services, to our CBT for chronic pain group. And then this is another project that I participated in with the California Department of Public Health, academic called Opioid Stewardship or Academic Detailing. This is an initiative to bring one-to-one structured educational visits from one healthcare provider to another to change prescribing practices, and it was based on pharma advertising techniques. So some of you may have recall that sort of also around the early 90s, there are a lot of sort of pharmaceutical reps that would go and talk with different physicians or providers one-on-one and talk about their new, you know, sort of products. And what you found, you know, and they would either do it through lunch or other, get sort of other perks that, you know, those physicians who had these one-to-one educational visits from these pharmaceutical reps tended to prescribe their products more. And so taking from that, we adopted it to do this opioid stewardship, where we could do these one-on-one educational visits, both with primary care providers and pharmacists, because pharmacists can also furnish naloxone to any patient when they're picking up a prescription at a pharmacy. And so one of the sort of educational content that we talk about is all, you know, sort of considering other treatments before opiate therapy for chronic pain. And that we know there, you know, the evidence now tells us opioid therapy is not really safe and actually not very effective for chronic pain management. And that there are a number of other options that we want to talk with the patient about and offer. And then also try out and say, oh, it didn't work for you. Let's give it a little trial period. You did try X, Y, and Z, and it didn't work for you, and so let's now consider other options before starting them on an opioid for chronic pain. So it includes some of the things we've already talked about, like chiropractic services, yoga, physical therapy, behavioral therapies, CBT, the relapse prevention group, a number of other alternative medications, including antidepressants, muscle relaxants, NSAIDs, and then a number of other sort of medical procedures like injections and orthopedics. And then just basic things like ice and heat and sort of, you know, sort of activity pacing and sort of taking breaks in between, those types of things. And one of the other things that we really strongly recommend is reevaluating the way you assess for pain. So as I mentioned earlier, generally the way that pain was assessed was the medical provider would ask on a scale of 0 to 10, where is your pain today? And then that's sort of how we treat it based on sort of this scale. And what we're recommending now is looking, yes, do a pain assessment. Where are you in terms of your experience of pain? Also, enjoyment of life. You know, how is that? How has pain impacted the way you're experiencing your life and you're living your life and your activity level? And based on those three areas, determine a treatment plan individually with that person. And then regularly reassessing based on this too, right? So when we first see someone and you're treating pain, do this initial assessment and then routinely do this at follow-up appointments. And then, of course, encouraging co-prescribing of naloxone, which is the antidote for an overdose. And then also encouraging prescription, using of the prescription drug monitoring program. So in 2013, was the first time where there was a requirement for health centers to go from a paper format of a medical record to electronic records. So that's when you really sort of see this shift, right? And I share that to say that now we are actually can track and see how prescription practices are happening. Before, it was really hard to do when all of this information was in a paper format. Now we're really encouraging providers to sign up for the system and to regularly check to see where the individual is getting their medications so that we can have, you know, really honest conversations around, it looks like you're receiving care here as well. Tell me more about, you know, sort of what's happening and how can we work together? And so that I can best sort of help, sort of meet your needs and offer you something that's safe and what we think is going to be actually helpful for you. And so in California, the system is called CURES. So anyone who can prescribe can access the system. So as a non-prescriber, I actually can access the system. And there are ways that you can become linked to a prescriber where you might have some limited access. And then lastly, in terms of a sort of more system level, I also participate in the accelerator program. I'm part of the East Bay Safe Prescribing Coalition. And this is a program that was launched in this year, 2018, from the California Opioid Safety Network. And it's an opportunity. There are 24 coalitions across the state that are participating in this. And the various coalitions get technical assistance and expert coaching. We get opportunities to network, learn best practices, and really align our efforts across the state. And so our first sort of coalition meeting will be happening this Thursday. So I'll get to meet all of my coalition peers. But we've been having webinars and other ways to connect. What has been the results of these efforts, both at a sort of patient, provider, and sort of more community level, is that there was a significant drop in opioid overdose in Alameda County in 2017, about half. Some of what we're doing is we're seeing the results of that. And there's still more, as I mentioned, that we need to do in terms of being able to increase access to this really effective intervention or treatment. And some of you may have more recently been hearing about opioid phobia, which is sort of this idea that some people are sort of talking about that we've gone to the other side of the pendulum where now we're under treating pain again, and that people who actually do benefit from opioid for chronic pain is not actually able to get access to it. And so we're at this interesting place where we really do have to find as a community a balance for that. We're just sort of cautious about prescribing opioids for pain because we have some pretty good evidence now that it's not safe and it's not that effective. But nonetheless, there are some who this might be the appropriate treatment for, and we want to be able to offer it if it's indicated, especially if they've tried all of the other interventions that are recommended as first-line treatment and really finding no relief from these interventions. So it'll be interesting to sort of see where that lands. And so that's where we're currently at. These are the different resources. Dreamland is a fantastic book. It's written by Sam Quijones. He's a crime writer. He was writing in Stockton at the time. He's in LA now. And he sort of writes about this and connects it with sort of the drug cartel in Mexico and sort of how it lands in sort of certain parts of the country and why it's been more significantly impacted in those areas. So really a fantastic read if you get a chance. Drug Dealer MD is also another fantastic book by Anna Lemke, and she talks about sort of the medical provider role in the opioid crisis. And then a number of SAMHSA and the CDC are great resources as well. And thank you for coming. And questions?
Yes, if anybody has any questions, I can. There we go. Okay.
Hi, I have a few questions. One is, do people remain on the buprenorphine for how long?
Yeah.
And the other is, have you had experience with your patients, any patients have been admitted to the hospital for surgery or some emergency motor vehicle accident or whatever, and what was their experience in terms of their treatment there? What were some of the issues that came up if they were on one of the medications you use?
Okay. So in terms of how long a patient or an individual is on buprenorphine, so like diabetes or hypertension and chronic, you know, sort of management, it's something that they're typically on for a long time. In some of the data, there are relapse is really high for substance use or addiction, about 80%. And so we do share that data. Usually we say it is probably something that you can expect to be using for a little while until you become a little more stable. And then we can reassess in terms of your quality of life, where things are at for you, and then considering a tapering. And there are some people who do taper. I've sort of read some of the forums online from people who've done it, and there's just sort of a wide range of experiences, and we just don't have enough data to really know if ultimately people can taper off of the buprenorphine. But we have some of that data to say it's, you know, the relapse is pretty high, and so that's something to consider when that's something you're looking to do. I had a patient, she was probably in her mid-20s, a female medical assistant who was initially prescribed an opioid because she was in a motor vehicle accident, and then could no longer get it, got onto addiction, and then also was buying prescription opioids sort of illicitly in the streets. And she came to me and she said, I want to get onto buprenorphine, but I don't want to be on it for very long because I want to have a baby, even though it's actually safe indicated for pregnancy. I want to have a baby. And so she got started, and she sort of on her own started to tape herself to lower doses. And she relapsed. We didn't see her for a little while. She came back, got back on buprenorphine, did the same thing, and we haven't seen her. So that's just sort of one story of someone who came into treatment saying, I don't want to be on this long term. I just want it to be on for a little while. And perhaps that little while, we need it to be a little longer for her. I don't think we ever said you couldn't, but let's just sort of watch and monitor and see. Then in terms of if they are on the treatment, we are doing sort of different educational initiatives in hospital settings where it's safe. They can also get it prescribed when they're in the hospital. There's an initiative at Highland Hospital in Oakland to actually start individuals on buprenorphine when they come into the ED in withdrawal. Then they connect them to an outpatient community clinic for ongoing maintenance and stabilization. Yeah. So that varies depending on sort of the situation and the provider. You can be. So the question is, can you be on another pain med and buprenorphine? So what you would think is no, because the buprenorphine is functioning to fill that mu receptor, and you're not going to get the effectiveness of the other opioid. Now, anecdotally, people tell me differently. So they'll say, you know, I was on buprenorphine, I had a little bit of a relapse, I used heroin, I kind of felt something, but not really. And so then they say, it's a waste of my money, I'm not going to use it anymore. So really, sort of neurochemistry would say, probably not that they would be on buprenorphine and a pain med. So depending on what the sort of needs were, the medical provider would probably choose one or the other, and hopefully connect with their outpatient provider to talk about continuity of care after that hospitalization.
So my understanding was the program started in around 2016 at your clinic.
Yes.
And approximately how many patients have been through the program?
Yeah.
And is your experience, I heard only 10% really make it through a program, but
yeah.
What's the data that you have so far?
I'll tell you that our first two patients are no longer with us. We sort of just had a sort of unusual case in general, but we have 17 patients now in the program. So we had a sort of ramping up period, about 6 months with hiring, starting the program, developing the workflow, the procedures, all of that. Then the referrals, and we'll get a number of referrals, but probably about 10% of those referrals will actually get started on treatment. And then there's a relatively sort of high rate of kind of dropout as well.
Yeah. So the other question, and maybe to answer your question, is maybe you don't use opioids with it when they're on the buprenorphine. I can't say that.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of nonsteroidals and other drugs that they could use, and maybe that would, in combination, be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we have another question.
Sure. Thank you, Tam. Can you say more about the stigma with providers and what you guys are doing to overcome that, aside from gamifying the access to info?
I think just ongoing communication about it, calling it out when it happens in a delicate and compassionate way. Just sort of naming it is what I've tried to practice in a way that's safe from sort of, you know, a colleague to another. And I think that's been helpful. Education, sort of exposure to other programs and other providers who do this all the time. So if you meet Andrew Herring at Highland Hospital, who is doing this work in the ED department, he sort of widely promotes it, says it's super safe, everyone should be getting it, you know. But it's a different context. In the emergency room, it's fast-paced, they're giving really strong medications all the time, you know, and so it's a really different kind of context. So I think exposure to other providers who are doing this and have found a lot of success. So that requires time and ongoing sort of education, talking about it across peers, between peers, and sort of calling it out when it's sort of showing up in the interaction or in the work that we're doing.
How do you deal with the polysubstance abuser who comes in and he's using meth and heroin and, you know, benzos and everything all at the same time?
Sure. So 80% of our patients probably are polysubstance users. And from a harm reduction approach, we sort of say, where are you in terms of your stage of change and what you're wanting to work on? We just know that at least we're getting them into one thing that's safer, we're still reducing risk. But it's challenging and sort of complicates the treatment plan. But the idea is that we're still getting them onto a treatment that's safer than them being on heroin or fentanyl. And, you know, meth and all these and benzos. In general, for individuals that are also on benzos and an opioid, we say this is really high risk, it's really dangerous. And of the two, which one could you start with considering tapering? And we sort of let them choose whether it's the benzo or the opioid. And then are you willing to try buprenorphine as another treatment option? And that conversation has to be with that we've talked about a potential opioid use, that they're meeting criteria for opioid use disorder as well. And that's another place that's just really hard to talk about in a primary care context. When it's safer to say I have chronic pain and that's why I need this versus I have an addiction and that's why I need this.
Okay, and ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to wrap up because there's another program coming in here in about 10 minutes. Dr. Nguyen has told me that she's happy to answer any of your questions down in the lobby. So I want to thank you very much for attending, and I hope you have a wonderful evening. Thank you, Dr. Nguyen.
Thank you.